Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network, a station dedicated to the concept that all manifestations of the divine are equally valid. Join Reverend Terry Power HP, Robin McKean, and all the hosts for programming covering a wide range of spiritual topics, right here on Blog Talk Radio.
Forest, a safe place where we have the freedom to think about life without judgment. We take a look at society, we examine it, and we allow for the possibility of something new, something different. And now, here's your host, Alan Ritter.
Well, welcome everyone to this Sunday night show, another show of an emerging forest on this 22nd of April, 2018, another 9 p.m., another start of a week. And I am very honored tonight to have Lindsay Napolitano and Johan Rinkens from Fields Without Fences, and we're continuing a story of a theme of farming and environment that we started last week with Experimental Farm Network. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alan.
Hi, Alan. Thanks.
So I certainly was familiar with your story from the time that we met several years ago, but I refreshed myself on your story. And you had quite a challenge and basically an environment in which you were set down and you were like, well, do we belong here? Should we continue to fight this, or should we just say this is a no-go? So do you mind talking about your origin story for a little while?
Yeah. Well, we moved out here to very end of 2010, going into 2011. It was an abandoned property at the time that Johan's mother had purchased, and she wasn't living there, but it was former agricultural land. So the land had been farmed for about 250, 300 years. This is an area of New Jersey that was colonized fairly early on by European settlers. And so initially we didn't necessarily have an intention of starting a farm here. We didn't necessarily even think we were going to be here for more than a matter of months. But as time rolled on, we started exploring. Johan comes from an annual vegetable background, so he had been farming organic vegetables for about 10 years at that point. And we just sort of assumed that the same cultivation style would be a possibility in this context. And we quickly learned that that wasn't the case. You know, if you're working with annual vegetables, you know, you're bringing machinery out into the field, you're plowing, you're tilling, you're planting your vegetables, you're growing them, the whole cycle starts over again. And in our context, the possibility of bringing machinery out into the field was a bit of a non-starter. Everything would just sort of sink into the ground, even small machinery like BCS. And there were frequently times during the year where you couldn't even really walk outside because you would wind up sinking in the mud. And so at that point, we started getting curious about, okay, well, we know that this is former agricultural land. The maps are showing that there is supposedly still loam soil here. You know, so what is going on that we only have this compacted clay subsoil and there is no topsoil left and there is standing anaerobic water all over the property and there is relatively low diversity in vegetation. Of course, all of these factors fold into one another because when you have acidification of the soil that exacerbates hard pan, which makes it difficult for water to percolate, which creates anaerobic conditions that only certain plants can survive in. So we started piecing together this understanding of what was happening on the ground. But then stretching it even further, it's that you then have to begin to ask yourself, okay, well, how did we get here? Why are we in a situation present day in a landscape that is in this really unique part of New Jersey? We're in a critical point in the Delaware River watershed where a tremendous amount of tributaries and creeks and streams are converging to flow into the Delaware River, which we're about a mile uphill from on a plateau and a cliffside. So reaching back into understanding our geographical context, we started looking into the deep history of the site. And so this is, as I mentioned, a really critical point in the watershed. It's also a tremendously vibrant, because of all of the water that's moving through this area, geographic niche. So people have been inhabiting these cliff sides for at least 10,000 years that we know of. We know that there were Native American campsites throughout these cliffsides. We have artifacts down at the local county municipal building from populations that were living here. And so when those populations were living here, it was very different. You had a diverse forest ecosystem happening. And you had flora and fauna, and you had an herbaceous layer in the forest and canopy trees. And fast forward 200 years into the future, we know that by the 1930s, there was all but a small strip of trees left just to the river. Everything else at that point had been cleared. So what happens when you begin clearing trees from the landscape and clearing a diverse root system out of a watershed is that you still have water movement through these cliff sides, but now you no longer have the roots stabilizing the soil. So at that point, we began to realize, oh, wow, the situation that we're encountering here on farmland that is no longer farmable has been something that's been unfolding over the course of centuries of land mismanagement. And in that way, the story isn't necessarily unique to our position here because this is a story that is widespread, particularly in our state, but across the country and across the world, increasingly so. We're dealing with the eventuality of landscape mismanagement. So at that point, we started thinking about, okay, well, how can we approach this more from an ecological restoration perspective? And at that point, we began developing a model that hybridized agriculture, but productive agriculture with ecological restoration, and endeavored to create a farm that resembled a forest ecology that would have been native to this particular area. So that was the beginning of our process here. It came out of a space of dealing with the eventuality of severed relationships with understanding functionality of ecosystems, and continued with us beginning to implement, to the best of our ability, a successional forest garden farm that we've been in the process of developing over the last 6 seasons.
Yeah, so from my not in-depth understanding, this is the consequence of annual agriculture, which is basically take and take and take and take and never give back. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I mean, and I don't want to diminish annual agriculture too much, because there's an appropriate scale and there's an appropriate place, but it's certainly not an application that a methodology of cultivation that can be applied universally to all landscapes, which is how we tend to treat our modern agricultural approach. So, you know, there are wonderful organic farmers who do a lot of giving back in an annual context, whether that's through cover cropping or, you know, incorporating mulch, compost, and, you know, certainly there's a process being enacted there. But what we're really talking about is developing a reference for what the ecology needs.
Your audio is dropping out there a little bit.
Just keep going. Okay. Johan, do you want to jump in and say something about that?
No, not necessarily. I think it's a pretty good summary of the annual ag side of things.
Yeah.
So there's a certain time period of, as you said, mismanagement, and it's on the order of, would you say 200 or 300 years?
Johan, do you want to jump in on that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think what Lindsay's pointing towards is the history of land use in our area that was, based off of removal of the forests and the implication of either livestock grazing, timber industry, annual cropping consisting of, broad scale disturbances where you're removing native ecosystems, implementing monocrops in the landscape and, utilizing that for decades at a time. In our case, on our property, the soil basically became unfarmable after a while. So, I'm sure back in history there was a more mixed homestead almost use of things here, livestock, orchards, vegetable, grain production. But from what we can gather in the last 20 to 30 years before it had stopped being farmed entirely in the mid to late 80s, was that it was most likely just a hay field. Most of the farmers in our area, the soil's become so wet and collapsed that there's only two types of operation, mulch hay operations and then a herbicide no-till system where, instead of actually disturbing the soil with a plow, you're spraying herbicide across acre upon acre and then drill seeding either a corn or a soy crop to that. So, for all intents and purposes, it kind of hit a wall in terms of our soil profile and its ability to support specific systems of agricultural cultivation.
So, in other words, the farmer's solution to your land at the point in which you come into the picture and for some decades before you arrive was, this isn't useful for anything anymore, just walk away from it, don't even do anything with it, abandon it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And,
okay.
You know, that, I mean, I was actually just thinking about that today because there was certainly, you know, especially early on, many times for us where the same sentiment started to arise, which is, okay, do we just walk away from this? Because it is so difficult to interface with, because the limitations that it presents makes farming, which is already a difficult endeavor, that much more difficult. But there was something during that time, and I have a specific memory of, you know, several conversations where I just had this nagging feeling of our work not being done here yet. And, you know, we're at a point where for people who, especially young people that are looking to get into farming, that are looking to have a career in agriculture, or some sort of land-based economy, the landscapes that are available to us aren't often prime landscapes, not the least of which because, you know, in New Jersey especially, real estate is very expensive, and most of the land across the country at this point has been disturbed. Some areas have been more disturbed than others, but we're finding ourselves increasingly more in the position where we are going to really not have a choice anymore about what type of land we want to work on. We're going to have the land that we have as a result of collective decision making in terms of management and development.
Yeah, I think there's a the real estate brokers saying, or somebody saying, is use what you've got. They're not making any more. So
right.
would you agree that from your experience, okay, you came into this piece of land and it was non-functional. And you had to do a certain recipe of restoration and regeneration, which you now understand a lot better than you did when you got into it. Would you say that there are other parcels of land that have been walked away from that are, from your perspective, not completely attractive because they require a lot of bootstrap heavy lifting, but if someone is looking to get into a piece of land and is willing to do that heavy lifting, the price tag might be more attractive?
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely a good insight, you know, in terms of both getting, you know, young folks on the back of the land. You know, we're facing a farming crisis in the States where, you know, farmers are aging out. There's not as many folks ready to replace them. And, you know, we're looking at an intergenerational shift coming up where a lot of the farmland in the States is going to be up for grabs and in transition. But at the same time, you know, young folks especially are leveraging student debt against, you know, the ability to purchase and invest in land. And it's definitely a tricky future that we're heading into, but it also presents a lot of, you know, creative opportunities for folks to, you know, get back on the land, take on more of a ecological restoration and productive kind of small scale farming and scale it from there piece by piece, and really presents an opportunity to rebuild the agricultural system from the ground up in a way.
So from a perspective of price, you're going to have the older generation of farmers, and if their land is still attractive, agribusiness is going to come in and pay the top dollar, and the only land that agribusiness is going to walk away from is the land like you moved on to. So literally the younger farmer with a few moths in their wallet is only going to be able to get a chance at the land that large agribusiness doesn't want. So from that perspective, the tools that you guys have, especially as relates to the biome, the New Jersey, Pennsylvania biome, is incredibly valuable because, I mean, you guys didn't jump onto your land and started doing everything, and everything you did was a success. Of course, you made a million mistakes and then found the road to success, which is normal. So to come to you guys and basically say, okay, what's in the first aid kit and what's not in the first aid kit is the place to start. Like, okay, somebody comes in and they say, okay, we're going to have a grassroots movement. How do we do this the most effectively? Well, we know what land we're going to get. So we go to Lindsay and Johan to get the recipe to get the land up as quickly as possible. And, you know, then after 5 years, you begin to have attractive property again.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think part of it, too, is that, we work in a lot of different landscapes in terms of, consulting projects. And, you know, sometimes it's, frequently we work with farmers. And then, of course, sometimes we work with landowners who maybe have a lot of acreage, or sometimes we work with, you know, smaller landscapes, residential. But in the same way that every landscape has a particular functionality in terms of how it relates to the larger ecology, there is a personal ecology that's happening with each steward of that landscape. So, you know, I don't want to say that we can take these degraded landscapes and, you know, on the ground, year or two later, you have this, you know, booming agricultural business and, you know, you're, I mean, you know, sometimes that's possible for sure. But more about, it's more about the relationship that develops. And so that's the relationship that you're having with your particular landscape. So frequently when we're working with clients, the first step of the process is something that we call, this is something that comes up quite a bit in permaculture language, but, you know, also in other fields as well, is this idea of goal articulation and really sitting and being present to what your goals are for the site. So in our case, we had a goal process that included, you know, very basically, and not to get into all the nuances of it, but very basically is that, you know, we wanted to first and foremost improve this landscape, improve the way that it functioned as a critical point in the watershed, improve it as a space for habitat, improve it in terms of its diversity, of its soil health. And then we also wanted to orient our lives around a nature-based business. So there's really not one prescription for any landscape because landscapes don't exist in separation. They really only exist in a state of relationship. As with all things in this universe, you know, it's like water falls on one part of the web and the whole web moves. So there's this level of interconnectivity in terms of what do you want out of your landscape? So, you know, I found myself when we were speaking at the NOFA New Jersey Winter Conference, we were on a permaculture panel, and I found myself presenting this paradox. Which is at the beginning of the conversation, I was talking all about the design that's implicit within the landscape. So meaning that every landscape that we inhabit has a particular functionality to it. So what is that functionality? Are you in, a riverbed area where you've got a lot of great soil and it's flatland because, you know, it was formerly covered by a river millions of years ago? Are you in a watershed? Are you in a dry landscape? Are you in a north-facing cliffside? All of these landscapes have a different functionality to them. And so when figuring out how to approach them, you want to be looking for the design that's implicit within that landscape and then working with that. So how can I bring in species that are going to do well in this context and more than do well, that are actually going to provide a beneficial context for this particular landscape? And then on the other hand, at the end of that panel discussion, I found myself saying, it all has to do with relationship and nothing is implicit. And so what I mean by that is that if you're installing a particular system or a particular approach to land cultivation that doesn't resonate with you, whether it doesn't resonate with you because you've set up a system that requires a lot of management and you don't want to necessarily be out there 17 hours a day, 7 days a week, or you've created a landscape that requires a financial input that you don't have available to you, things are going to start to go outside of the vision. Things are going to start to go awry. There's going to be feedback that isn't necessarily aligned with what your core intention may have been. So it's this idea that, you know, at all times, landscapes develop in relationships. So there's, you know, a lot of interesting examples of this where you find plants that are growing in areas that, you know, plants that are growing by rivers that are actually upland dry plants in, you know, older forests. Well, why are they there? Well, they're there because human populations planted them there a very long time ago. So, you know, just, you know, I was teaching a forest garden workshop once and I was talking about how squirrels design ecosystems, right? Because, you know, the squirrel takes the nut, you know, it brings the nut somewhere, it stores that nut, you know, maybe it gets back to it, maybe something happens to the squirrel, it never devours that nut grows into a tree in a new location, you know, designed by a squirrel. So everything is relationship dependent. Everything is happening in the context of feedback. So, so I just wanted to bring that up in terms of what is the prescription for each land base. It really has to do with the design that's implicit within the landscape and harnessing that potential, but then also understanding how relationship is really going to dictate the success or failure of any particular installation.
So that is, that point gets at, we're coming at this as conscious people, and if you're in agribusiness or a business that is tied to the market, what you're seeing is I have to deliver, I would like to deliver, my goal is overall to deliver an income of a certain amount from the land.
Mm-hmm.
My more recent goal is less about that and more about being able to place value on increasing the capability of the land to carry other fertility potential, not for human economy, but for plant diversity economy, something that's not so-called valuable to me as I go and try to make a living, but is valuable to the biosphere and is actually valuable to broadening the potential of that particular area to hold fertility. And I don't really understand how to speak. I understand that I would be receiving less dollars from the land, but have you guys ever thought of a way to say, no, what we're actually doing is increasing the fertility in a valuable way that's sort of off the quote-unquote books?
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, I just want to say something kind of quick about that, and then I'll throw it over to Johan. But, you know, I just want to, like, you know, this is something that actually we talk about quite frequently, which is to pick apart this idea what does it mean to generate, to make a living off of the landscape. So there's a couple different ways to parse that apart, because it's a question that frequently gets asked, but it's not actually a very thoughtful question, because the landscape has an overabundance. There is no shortage of abundance. If you know how to use plants, if you know how to work with them, if you know how to relate to animals in a productive way, there is no shortage. Now, that
right.
said, you can grow am I cutting out?
No, you're good. You're good.
No, you're good.
Oh, no, I'm good. Okay, I thought somebody said something. All right. So there's no shortage of abundance. Even in our context, theoretically, we could be making a tremendous amount of money off of what we have growing on site. But there's other market factors, which is to say, can you sell all of that? Is there a market context for all of that? If you're a farmer, you're doing everything that a farmer does, which is grow plants, fix machinery, seed starts. It's an endless job in itself, but you're also a small business owner. So you're doing your own marketing. You're doing your own admin work. You're doing your own, financial books, maybe. There's all of these ways in which a capitalist economy isn't necessarily responding to what is actually available becomes this issue of sellability. So that question of, when people say, like, oh, well, can you make a living off of this? Well, I don't know. Can you? Do you have the resources? Because the landscape more than provides for what we need. There's enough food. There's enough fiber. There's enough medicine. All of this exists in a tremendous and relatively simple scenario and setup. But it's how do we then transition that to a capitalist economy? So that's really what we need to parse out when we ask that question, to take more of a critical look at exactly what type of economic scenario we're operating in. And Johan's actually a lot more critical and smart about these things than I am, so I would throw it to him if you had anything to contribute.
What I'd like to do at this point, let's pick that up right after the break. But right now I'd like to take a break, and I'd like to play the song by Darv the Bard, Howl and Toe. Hey, everybody out there. We'll be back right after the break. See you in a few minutes.
When you were born, your father wore it, and your father wore it too. We'll be right back.
International Pagan Radio. You can hear your favorite artists such as Dave the Bard, Tuatha Dea, Spiral Rhythm, S.J. Tucker, Murphy's Midnight Rounders, and many, many more. Join us for exciting shows like Ask a Witch and Storytime with Rook as well. www.internationalpaganradio.com on the net or on TuneIn Radio on your mobile devices. Join us on Facebook and Twitter too. International Pagan Radio, all pagan, all the time.
Welcome back to an emerging forest on the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. We hope everyone was able to stretch their legs and get a drink. And now, back to Alan.
So just before the break, we were talking about economies, and Lindsay threw the question over to Johan. So Johan, why don't you pick it up from there?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I really liked where Lindsay was going with that. For me, it kind of brings up these notions of, you know, surplus and scarcity and you know, abundance versus scarcity. And just the way that, you know, oftentimes market forces are looking to economize something into a unit that is intelligible. So how do we, you know, equate a bushel of corn into a dollar value? And when we're looking at complex landscapes with complex yields coming out of them or multi-abundant yields, it becomes very hard to pull all those pieces apart and actually put, you know, a dollar unit per se on each item, if you will. So, you know, what does this mean for us moving into the future, moving into new economies and new ways of being in the world? You know, is, I think, still an open-ended question, but it's certainly one that I think is worth, you know, struggling with and thinking through. You know, what does it look like to create landscapes where, you know, if you were to come in, it might actually look like the wilds on the side of the road or a forest that is, you know, somewhat unintelligible to an outside perspective. But when you start peeling apart the layers and looking at the plants and the communities and the interactions between the elements in the landscape, there's a complexity that arises just from the interrelationship between all those you know, entities within an area.
Yeah, and then when you have a stabilized ecosystem, or when you have a stabilized, you know, functional natural landscape that is yielding and that has abundance implicit within it, you don't need to put as much input into it, input in the form of energy, in the form of fossil fuels, in the form of machine application, even in the form of physical labor to a certain degree. So, you know, you start kind of balancing it out and looking at it in a new economic context, which is like our approach, which is to say, how can we create minimal input systems so that we're not, you know, part of like this emphasis to reach a point of capital profit on a particular operation, you know, it's expenses versus, you know, income and assets. So if you're limiting your expenses because you're not having to prop up an unstable system with all of these inputs, then you know, you're reaching your bottom line faster, if that makes sense.
So maybe from a perspective of economy, certainly the squirrel doesn't have to go to the bank and use the ATM, because all the squirrel's needs are provided for. So the more deeply you understand the ecosystem and are provided for by it, as in your entire way of living changes from the, oh, I must have a house, oh, I must have a car, to actually living within the structures provided by nature, maybe people look at you and they don't understand you, but you're less reliant on the dollar capitalization and more reliant on the abundance that just is just naturally there. Does that make sense?
You want to respond to that?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that does make a lot of sense to me, and that's how humanity has lived on the planet for much longer than we've lived in a system based off of, you know, taxation and property value and commodity exchange that's associated, you know, forms.
It's actually giving up our own volunteered enslavement and becoming in touch with the land and sort of saying, oh, excuse me, here's the bank card back. I don't need it anymore. Something like that.
Yeah, so I mean, in a long-term scenario, and I'm not sure the material conditions are quite there yet, but you know, one can
only
hope.
I mean, I tend to look at things in extremes, and also in comedy and sort of duality perspective.
Yeah.
And I think it goes back to, you know, this is the diversity of your own goals for yourself. So what works in your particular context? So, you know, I mean, you're not far off in that there are a lot of people right now, especially younger folks, but also, you know, folks later in life who are kind of, you know, going towards more of a minimal nature-based existence. So whether that means, you know, they have a tiny home and they're, you know, there's all different ways that you can relate to your environment. Now, that said, you know, not everyone wants to relate to their environment that way. So, you know, I appreciate the tiptoeing or you know, moving into extremity, because I think that push into extremity is actually what moves the conversation along, because it rides the edge, and that's where a lot of new thought and conversation develops from. But at the same time, you want to say, look, it's not all or nothing. So you can have your house, you know, and you can have your car. And I mean, you know, we're all talking on, you know, cell phones right now or computers, whatever we're using. You know, you can still do good work for the earth. You can still develop and cultivate a deeper relationship with your ecological context, you know, without completely moving out of your current comforts. You know, of course, taking a critical
right.
eye
there would
them
be,
and always moving forward. Yeah.
Yeah, there would be a lot of learning that would be required, and it is to our eyes, looking back at the American Indian as a model, there would be a lot of if you're looking directly at their lifestyle, it appears at first glance to be a lot harsher. And so there are not that many people who would be jumping up and down with their hand raised to say, I want that. So let's just jump ahead and talk for a short period of time about what are some simple steps that you would recommend, either of you would recommend, to your what I would say your suburban 1/10 or 2/10 of an acre residential homeowner for dealing with their quote-unquote backyard, which is sort of one step away from a collapsed ecosystem?
It's an interesting question. I think, you know, there's this element of wild space. I think that could be incorporated, you know, looking at corners of the property, abandoned edges, perimeters, and looking to those spaces for areas of beauty, areas of respite, and, you know, incorporating wildflowers into areas like that, herbaceous herbs, areas that are difficult to mow in the landscape. How can we convert these into, you know, pollinator habitats that encourage butterflies and hummingbirds? There's a multitude of ways that one can interact with their landscape in a context like that where, you know, we're getting both a food value out of it. If you have small-scale garden boxes close to the entrance door, if you're growing culinary herbs that you can pick before dinner and bring a little bit of that, you know, flavor and fresh grown aroma into the kitchen. So, yeah, it's...
Yeah, and, you know, I think also stepping back to look at how your particular small patch of land relates to the land around you, and then beyond that relates to, you know, as I mentioned, your geographical context. So, and then sort of beginning to orient yourself as part of a larger interconnected whole rather than, you know, an isolated island. So how can you work with water in your landscape in a way that's more harmonious to the way that water wants to flow through your landscape? You're part of a patchwork, but certainly, you know, especially if you take a more communal approach, which is, you know, a novel idea of working with your neighbors and, you know, creating something that's more of a collective understanding of, you know, how to relate to your local ecosystem. And then my other recommendation just to add on would be to get to know the plants that are coming up. And not in this sort of reactionary way that we tend to relate to plants as humans, which is this qualitative approach to say, oh, I love these plants, but I detest these plants. And, oh, you know, these plants are native and these plants are invasive. And, you know, and it just creates this, it creates this attitude of conflict and holding on to control. And that's what I see in a lot of suburban yards, a tendency to want to have complete control over the landscape. And there's, and in order to have a mutual relationship, it begins with understanding. So it begins with understanding, okay, well, maybe you don't like this plant, but why is it showing up? Because that's going to give you some clues as to what's going on in your landscape once you begin to understand why certain plants show up in certain areas. But then from that space of mutual understanding, you can take a more collaborative approach, which is to say, okay, this is where I would like to see the landscape move into. So how can I begin to work in more of a collaborative spirit rather than a, I'm going to beat this landscape into submission sort of approach?
So if your landscape is saying, okay, there's pioneers on the landscape, there's plants that are breaking up compaction, there's plants that are deep tapping for minerals, it's telling you about the condition of your soil. And if you're saying, well, my goodness, I'd rather have these other plants, well, maybe the condition of the soil is completely unsuited for plants that are 5 or 6 steps down the road of rehabilitation of the land. And you just flat out can't have what you want right now. You've got to, as you said, have a collaboration with reality. And sure, you have goals and you can move toward your goals, but, you know, April 20, you know, 3rd or 22nd of this year, you're at the place you are right now. Maybe 3 or 4 years from now, you can get more toward the fertility profile or the soil profile you'd like to, but not right now.
Yeah. you know, that's a big part of this work. So, you know, the answer is yes and yes, right? Because on the one hand, you can get there faster in inputs, you know, whether that's in the form of, you know, bringing in some sort of compost or mulch into the situation, whether that's in the form of, you know, implementing some mechanical measures. You know, there are ways to tip the scales of time, so to say. So that it's twofold, right? Because the landscape, so, and then, it, you know, to tie it back to our own story, this is something that Johan and I have talked about at length over years now, which is to say, we came into this damaged landscape, but it's a bit of a misnomer to say, oh, we came in and we healed it. Because the reality is that this landscape was healing itself. It was just on a time trajectory that falls outside mm-hmm. of our human scope, meaning to say that we exactly. could not get a positive landscape to manifest in this particular landscape in the time frame that we wanted to see it happen, you know, in our, you know, 75, 85 years as human beings, if we're lucky, right? So it goes back again to this idea of relationship, because that's what we're doing in all of these contexts. So that's what we're doing with ecological restoration. We're tipping the scales of time using these measures because we want to inhabit a landscape that has, you know, a level of productivity to it or a level of functionality to it. And so one is not better or worse than the other. It's just going back to what type of relationship you want to have, what you want to see manifest, you know, and also just being aware that, you know, that we're always working in collaboration. And context.
That's a very telling point that you make about time and about our quote unquote ego and our impatience with letting things take place, quote unquote, on a natural time scale. We're saying, oh, we need that, you know, snap our fingers, snap, things must be as we wish them to be, and we're willing to take these extraordinary measures, whereas you just said nature was taking those extraordinary measures, but on a much longer time scale.
Yeah, but I mean, that also just comes down to species survival. I mean, it's part of our nature to want to do that. And we're not the only animals that modify our environment so that we can live in them. Many animals do that with a conscious application of it. So it's not even just from a passive context, but you see this all the time. It's this impulse for survival. So you can take that into, you know, a larger existential framework, you know, to dive deeper into, but there's, you know, parsing out what your goals are, and again, I don't want to fall too much into a black and white reality on this, because I don't think that it is black and white. I think that it's very natural to want to survive, and I actually think it's that survival impulse that inspires, you know, folks like us who are working towards ecological regeneration, folks who are working for, you know, the earth renewal. We're coming at it from this survival standpoint. There's other people
right.
who are doing very destructive things in the world right now, but in their own sort of twisted reality, perhaps, that's also coming from a place of survival, you know, distorted, you know, maybe not thoughtful, but it's this impulse of, you know, what Johan was saying before about this idea of this scarcity mentality. But, you know, very realistically is that if we keep treating the planet like we have been, our species isn't going to be able to survive. So there's this kind of impulse right now to say, okay, we've radically devastated the planet. How can we use our tools, our resources, our consciousness, our know-how to now accelerate it in a beneficial direction and to inspire a rapid regeneration that we can potentially see in our lifetime? You know, that said,
right,
we plant trees all the time that we will not yield from. It's like, you know, somebody will get that walnut crop, you know, down the line.
Right.
So
in a few minutes, in a nutshell, could you summarize Field Without Fences and give your contact information?
Sure. I'll do a quick and then Johan, you can add on. Field Without Fences, we are a mom and pop operation. It's just Johan and I. We have a 10-acre farm that is being managed as a successional forest garden. We grow fruits, nuts, berries, culinary and medicinal herbs, wild edibles. We have an herbal product line that is available on our website. We also provide permaculture and ecological consulting work. So we're working regionally from Virginia up through New England with water management systems, ecological restoration, agroforestry, and our site is fieldswithoutfences.org, and we also have some events coming up and educational programs. Am I missing anything, Johan?
No, I think that's a really good wrap-up.
Okay.
So what are those, could you just go down the list of what the programs and events are that are coming up?
Sure. Well, we've got an introduction to permaculture weekend intensive, which is very intense in a good way. We cover a lot of material, and it's a great way to, if you're interested in learning to design with nature, it's a great way to jump into that. That's being hosted on farm. We're also, I've got some herbal medicine programming. So teaching next weekend, I do equinox and solstice plant walks, which are very fun. And then we're doing a learning to read the landscape weekend intensive at the end of June, which I highly recommend. It's a great opportunity to learn how to do those things that we were talking about earlier in this conversation, which is understand what your environmental context is telling you and begin that collaborative relationship with your local ecology.
Well, Johan and Lindsay, thank you so much for joining me tonight. It's been a really great program. I hope all my listeners will, in the present time and in the future, will get a lot out of it. They'll have to get a lot out of it because we covered so much really interesting ground. My name is Alan Ritter, and I'm the host of Emerging Forest. My email address is RITTER.ALAN88@gmail.com, and I, among other things, I run a small produce business in the southeastern Pennsylvania and southern New Jersey area, and you can locate me either by sending me an email at the address I just gave or going to produceclub.us, which will take you to a Facebook page. Thank you so much for being on the program tonight. I really enjoyed it. So have a good night, guys. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks a lot, Alan.
Thanks, Alan. Appreciate it. Great talk.
Okay.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Spiritual Unity Radio Network. Join us 7 nights a week for exciting programming covering a variety of expressions of faith. And remember, all manifestations of the divine are equally valid.